Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 50 years ago, Marvin Gaye made a creative leap of faith and gave us one of the most enduring works of the 20th century, his 1971 album, What's Going On? On this anniversary of the album's release, we're spending an hour talking to people about the record and about the community that gave rise to Marvin Gaye's masterwork.
There's a quote from Marvin where he was like, "I can't sing about stuff that's not in my heart right now." And what was in his heart was honestly despair.
That's Justin Tinsley of ESPN's The Undefeated. He'll tell about the friends who made it possible for Marvin Gaye to conceive of the album. Also, scholar and poet Melba Boyd on Detroit of 1971, and music historian David Hepworth. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the release of Marvin Gaye's monumental album, What's Going On?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
We're going to look back at what was going on with Marvin, with his home of Detroit, and around the world. Let's start with the history of the creation of this highly political, deeply personal album. It began with the title track, What's Going On? Here's WDET's Ann DeLisi.
Well, one of the things that inspired it was his brother was serving in Vietnam.
Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
And so he was, you know, mindful and moved by that. But when it came time to do this album, he was ready for a change. You know, his entire life had been going in a different direction, and his music certainly followed that. He wasn't even going to record this song himself originally. He wasn't going to be the one. He wanted to produce it, but he didn't want to be the singer and perform it. It was actually intended for the Four Tops because it was written by one of the Four Tops, Obie Benson. And the Tops thought it was too political. I think they even tried to get Joan Baez to record it, and she turned it down as well. So eventually, Marvin Gaye ended up recording it, and it was written by Marvin Gaye and Obie Benson, and they and Al Cleveland, I should also mention, he wrote it as well. So the three of them wrote this song. And it was inspired by the police brutality that Obie Benson witnessed. So Marvin Gaye had these feelings about his brother being in Vietnam, and Obie Benson saw this police brutality that was put upon these anti-war protesters.
Oh, but who would they judge us? Simply cause our hair is
So Berry Gordy was on board with this. This was someone who built his empire primarily on dance tunes and love ballads.
I think that Berry Gordy thought it was one of the worst songs he ever heard. And he had no interest in putting it out. And Marvin said that God, you know, this album was written and this song was written by God, that this was something that he was called to write. And he wasn't going to budge on it. Actually, he refused to record another note until this song was put out. And they sort of went around Berry Gordy. Harry Balk, who was the head of A&R at Motown Records, connected with Barney Ailes, who was in charge of distribution, sales and distribution, and knew how to get airplay. It was Barney Ailes who got it printed. You know, he got it pressed, I should say, and got it to a bunch of radio stations. And I think the day they put it out, it sold 100,000 copies. And then it just went from there, and it became a million seller.
Incredible. What did it take in terms of getting this song made? Was there anything else going on behind the scenes that you think is maybe lost?
Well, that Berry Gordy didn't know what was being made is the first thing. You know, he knew everything that was going on at Motown. He didn't know that this song was being made. Eventually, Marvin would sing on it. And then, of course, he had his friends Mel Farr and Lem Barney. You know, you hear at the beginning of that song, those are their voices.
Hey, what's up now? Brother, what's up?
And they were, they were part of the Detroit Lions at the time. And by the way, Marvin Gaye thought he wanted to be a football player and tried out for the Lions. And I think he got sacked a couple of times, and that sort of put that whole idea to bed. But they were his friends, and he brought them in. One of the other things that I should mention with this album, with this song, is that Marvin Gaye started to dress differently. So we hadn't seen him dress this way. We hadn't heard him sound this way. And it was just a complete shift for him. Also, one of the biggest things that Marvin Gaye did with the album, I know we're talking about the song, but this was the first time that the Funk Brothers and the artists and the other musicians that played on the album were actually credited so that we could see their names. And then, of course, the music itself. I should also mention one more thing, is that Marvin Gaye ended up using a technique of doubling and tripling his voice.
War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
That was done on this song by accident.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today.
The engineer at the time recorded Marvin. He wanted to have two different versions of his own take to use. And they ended up getting sort of recorded together. And when Marvin heard it, he loved it. And so that was something that was different for this approach from a recording standpoint.
And this is a song that came out in 1971. Did it in some ways pave the way for what was going to come later from artists like Stevie Wonder and others that were suddenly going to put some very different and more personal and more political things in their writing and their music at Motown?
Certainly with this song and this different approach to making music at Motown, it showed other artists what was possible. And it would have to open the eyes of Berry Gordy that things were changing. You know, the approach that Motown had taken for so long wasn't going to continue to work quite as well. And then, of course, comes the Temptations with their psychedelic era, and they were dealing with social issues as well. So, Marvin Gaye was very well respected, and this definitely had caused a shift. This album and this song caused a shift at Motown for sure.
What does it say to you that from 1971 to 2021, the song still feels so relevant?
Well, that's another conversation altogether. It speaks to our society. It speaks to the fact that we are still wrestling with some of the same issues that inspired Marvin Gaye to write this song. So it would tell me that we have a lot of work to do still. But the fact that this song resonates with people and that they still love the performance of it and the message of it, that's the beautiful part of music. You know, it can stand the test of time and reflect our thoughts and our feelings about what's going on in our society. You know, we're always kind of amazed when we say about this song, and this was, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we always say, oh, this song could have been written today. That's the sort of sobering part of it, is that it is still so relevant today, and we would have hoped that we would have gotten past a lot of the things that Marvin Gaye was addressing and was inspired by to write this song. So we have some work to do.
Marvin Gaye wasn't the only artist to put his notes on the world into song form in 1971. There were people across the music industry pushing themselves creatively that year.
Whereas I wouldn't wish an evening's 1971 television on my worst enemy, an evening of 1971 music of all kinds tends to slip down perfectly easily with people who are 24 nowadays, as well as people who are in their 60s or their 70s.
That's David Hepworth. He's a music journalist from the UK, if you hadn't guessed. And he's also author of the book Never a Dull Moment, 1971, the year that rock exploded. Motown wasn't exploding in 1971, but as Hepworth explains, it was going through changes.
Because I think the main focus for Motown in 1971 was the enormous success of the Jackson 5 and Dinah Ross as a solo artist.
Diana, starring Diana Ross.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Jackson 5!
And then Marvin Gaye was rather on the back burner in those times. And the success of What's Going On was just one of those bizarre accidents that occur from time to time in the music business.
Let's take the bigger picture now. There were so many major albums released in 71. Can you run us through a few of your favorites?
Well, it's the obvious, it's Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers, Led Zeppelin 4, David Bowie's Hunky Dory, Carole King's Tapestry, Sly and the Family Stone, There's a Riot Going On. All kinds of records there, James Taylor, Mudslide Slim, Joni Mitchell's Blue. I think the thing that fascinates me about it is that those records from that year are still played nowadays by people who weren't around at the time, because there was something about the way records were made in 1971. And what I think is they had just enough time and not too much. They had just enough money and not too much. They had just enough freedom and not too much. And also, the thing that we do not realize, we think the world of music nowadays moves far more quickly than it moved back then. Not true. It moves far more slowly nowadays than it moved then. So when people wanted to do things in 1971, they just did them. And they did them very, very quickly. And they got out there very, very quickly. And they got response very, very quickly in a way that simply doesn't occur anymore.
Marvin Gaye's sound with What's Going On spoke to a lot of political outrage of the day, that certainly that people were feeling in Detroit, Michigan. And yet there was so much going on in the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Can you think of other bands that had watershed records that year that had these overtly political overtones?
Not so much overtly political overtones. I suppose the thing that still fascinates me is that if you look at Christmas 1971, the top-selling album in the whole of the United States, and was at number one for, I think, about a month, was Sly and the Family Stone's There's a Riot Going On, which is an absolutely extraordinary record in all kinds of ways. You listen to it nowadays, it sounds really advanced. And that was in the mainstream in 1971. And so everything was heard by everybody. And that's a really important point, So What's Going On would be played on the radio alongside, the Carpenters and Carole King and the Rolling Stones and Brown Sugar and all that kind of thing. It would all part of one kind of mix. And that's a thing that I think we find it very hard to get our heads around nowadays.
More with David Hepworth on the backdrop for What's Going On and other earth-shaking records released in 1971 after a quick break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're reflecting this hour on the legacy of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Today's the 50th anniversary of the album's release. Let's pick back up with music journalist and author David Hepworth. Some people feel that all of American music is essentially black music. And in terms of black artistry, 1971 feels like the edge of a lot of important things. I mean, as you mentioned, Stevie Wonder was about to unleash everything that he was capable of out from under Berry Gordy's control. Funkadelic put out Maggot Brain that year. Bill Withers made his debut with Just As I Am. James Brown and Curtis Mayfield's music were about to go through a big change. Do you think that Marvin Gaye did something for the larger ecosystem by putting this record out and showing that it could be done?
Well, I think he wasn't the only one. I mean, the one you haven't mentioned, which I think was Rolling Stone's record of the year, 1971, was, which nobody talks about anymore, is Al Green Gets Next to You. Al Green was very much at the peak of his powers in 1971. I think what you traditionally had was that African-American artists, now I'm looking at this from a British point of view as well, they were celebrated for 7-inch 45s. They were celebrated for short tunes and fantastic dance music and ballads and so forth. What started to change in 1971 is these artists thinking, no, I can do something over 35 minutes. All musical artists like doing things over 35 minutes, because they think it represents a kind of a level of respect that the 7-inch 45 doesn't deliver for them. And what was happening in 1971 was that, you know, music was a bit of a greenfield site. You know, this was a relatively new medium. The idea that you would let young artists go and do what they wanted, because if you were the record company, you didn't know what the market wanted. They appeared to know what the market wanted. And they tried things. And a huge number of the things that they tried in 1971, nobody had ever tried before. You know, you hadn't heard a record like What's Going On before. Nowadays, you can hear loads of records that have shades of What's Going On about them. Back then, you hadn't heard anything like that before. Similarly, you hadn't heard anything like Carole King's Tapestry before or Joni Mitchell's Blue. These were new things. And the nearest analogy I can provide to that moment is if you look at what's going on nowadays or what's been going on the last 5 or 10 years, with streaming television, long-form television, where suddenly television is embracing a very different way of telling stories. A similar thing was happening with the long-playing record in the early 70s. And strangely enough, you could be commercially rewarded for doing something that's quite radical, as was the case with Marvin Gaye. But nobody envisaged it because what's going on, it was done as a single. Barry Gordy didn't want to put it out. It was only when it was at number one, he thought, we need an album. And then the album was lashed together really, really quickly.
David Hepworth is a music journalist and author of 1971, Never a Dull Moment. David, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's no question that the music of 1971 reflected the global struggles of the era. But part of what elevates What's Going On is the private and personal strife that Marvin Gaye was going through.
Where he was at that point in time in his life, it, as Lim and eventually Mel would come to understand, was he was in a state of transition.
That's Justin Tinsley. He's a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated, and he's talking about Detroit Lions Hall of Famers Lem Barney and Mel Farr. Tinsley interviewed Lem and Mel back in 2015 about how they came to be friends with Marvin Gaye and ended up as background vocalists on What's Going On. Marvin met Lem Barney in 1968, and Justin says that their friendship began at a critical time in Marvin Gaye's life.
Almost a year earlier, his singing partner, Tammy Terrell, had collapsed in his arm during a performance, and come to find out, she had cancer. And this took a deep, deep emotional toll on him. He was watching one of his best friends slowly succumb to cancer. During this point in time as well, in the summer of 1968, we know about the racial strife and you know, urban decay. And so he was dealing with that. His brother was in Vietnam, and he was seeing a generation of young men just being shipped over to a war that he really, truly didn't understand the purpose for. So it was getting harder and harder for him to sing love songs because he wanted to talk about the world that he saw outside of the studio. So that's where he was in the summer of 1968 in terms of the direction that he wanted to go with his music and what he saw right outside of his front door. You know, there's a quote from Marvin in his biography with David Ritz, Divided Soul, where he was like, I can't sing about love in June when people are out here dying in the streets. I'm paraphrasing it. Those aren't his exact words. But the genesis of what he was saying is, I can't sing about stuff that's not in my heart right now. And what was in his heart was honestly despair. So when he met Lem Barney, because he met him first, and this was the summer of 1968, Lem Barney, he was starting, I believe, his second season in the NFL at that point, and they had training camp. So before training camp, he went to Palmer Park Golf Course in Detroit just to get a round of golf in. And after that, Lem went to the clubhouse and he was like, hey, doesn't Marvin Gaye live here, live nearby or something like that? And they were like, yeah, he lives right down the street. Now, 1968, in terms of access to celebrities, is a lot different in in comparison to 2021. So they told him where he lived, and he knocked on the door, and Marvin Gaye knew who he was. And to make a long story much shorter, they established an instant friendship because Marvin was a huge sports fan. He loved the Detroit Lions, he loved the Tigers, and he loved all types of sports. And he was a sports fanatic. He wasn't just a guy that just come to the game to be seen because he was a celebrity. He actually knew the sports in and out.
You tell the story that Mel Farr and Len Barney actually had a role in encouraging Marvin Gaye to record this song, and that in turn he said he would do this if they would join him and play a part in the recording. Why do you think he wanted Lem and Mel to be part of the background vocals?
So Marvin meets Lem, and he eventually meets Mel, and they form like this almost instantaneous brotherhood. Again, we talked about where Marvin was at this point in time in his career and in his life, and Marvin, he didn't trust a lot of people. You know, he didn't trust a lot of people, but he trusted Lem and he trusted Mel because he knew that they weren't trying to get anything from him. They just enjoyed each other's company. And as, you know, as black men in the late 60s, that type of comfort was everything, because you're living in a country that looks at you as a second class citizen, regardless whether you're Marvin Gaye or you're a professional football player or you're a school teacher or whatever the case may be. They understood what their role in society was and how society viewed them. So there was this brotherhood that formed that was deeper than music, that was deeper than sports. So they hung out all the time. They played golf together. They played sports together. They, you know, drank beers together. So he trusted them to talk about, you know, where he wanted to take his career. And he mentioned it over a round of golf one day that he was working on this song that was a different sound than what he was used to doing. And of course, it was a different sound from what Motown was doing, because Motown was the sound of young America, and it was happy-go-lucky. It was love songs. It was lovey-dovey. It wasn't talking about actual societal issues, and that's what this song was doing. And so he was telling Lem and Mel about it, and he was explaining it, and he was singing some of the lyrics, and they were just like, man, you need to do that song. Like, you need to do it because that reflects our reality. And that is your responsibility as an artist to project that. And he was like, all right, cool. And in a roundabout way, he was like, all right, cool, I'll do it. But if I do it, y'all have to get on the song with me. Once Lem and Mel saw that he was serious, they looked at each other and was like, he's really adamant about doing this song. And we appreciate and we respect and we support the lyrics in the song. So why, you know, if he's serious about it, why not jump on it with him?
When we talk about the lasting message of what's going on, one of the things that's striking is this joy and friendship in the opening conversation between Mel and Lem.
Hey, what's up, man?
Brother, what's up? This is a
good recording, man.
Why did you think that the inclusion of that joy is important to the story of a song that is devoted to witnessing pain and witnessing strife?
You know, the black experience in America, it's a lot of things, but monolithic is not one of them. You know, we're not all one emotion every time. And I think the joy that came from that friendship between Lem and Marvin and Mel and Marvin, that joy gave him the confidence and the trust and the vulnerability to really take his career in a different direction. I'm not saying that Mel Farr and Lem Barney are the reasons that Marvin Gaye recorded that song. They're one of the many reasons, but they are a reason, because in that brotherhood where he found this unbridled joy when he needed it the most in his life, because again, remember that Tammy Terrell died in March 1970, right before she turned 25. And that gutted Marvin. That gutted him. He felt that he had lost a piece of his own soul. He cried at the funeral as he spoke. So he's going through all of these different, you know, tumultuous life events. The Vietnam War and his brother over there, and that's really taking a toll of him. Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, and he's taking all of these things personally. But throughout all of that, he had that friendship with Lem and Mel, and we know the value of a friendship. And once you find a community, a core that you can trust in, that you can be vulnerable in, you feel even more confident to speak on these things. And that's why, you know, that's why the joy of that friendship allowed Marvin to be completely honest on what's going on, because he knew if nothing else, his homeboys had his back. he had support because he knew he wasn't going to get support from the label, because Berry Gordy hated the record at first until he saw what it did in terms of sales. But he knew he had that support system. He knew, if nothing else, Mel and Lim would be there to support him, because they were the ones that told him, bro, you need to record this song. This song is important and the world needs to hear it.
Yeah. Marvin Gaye ended up trying out for a spot on the Lions with some guidance and support from Mel Farr and Lem Barney. And it didn't quite work out, but Mel told you that he believes this was one of the happiest and the healthiest times in Marvin Gaye's life. Did they say anything to you when you were talking to them about maybe that period and what changed for Marvin Gaye to move him into a darker place?
He records the song What's Going On, and he's very appreciative and very grateful for Lem and Mel to be on there. Now, Marvin had been around the Detroit Lions for a couple of seasons at that point. You know, he would come to games all the time. He would hang out with the players and their wives and their girlfriends at, you know, local lounges in Detroit, and he would perform there sometimes. So he was a pretty permanent fixture around the culture of that team. But after recording that song and after seeing the success of that song, and he had his quote unquote teammates Lem and Mel with him, he was like, okay, so y'all were teammates with me on this song. What about me being a teammate with y'all? And they were, and again, the same way when he asked them to be on the song, they were like, come again, Marvin? like, what are you talking about? He was like, I want to try out for the Lions. Keep in mind, Marvin Gaye's 31 years old. He has not played organized athletics, you know, at any point in his life. And now he played pickup basketball. He played sports just recreationally, but never organized. So they didn't think he was serious, but he convinced them that he was serious. And this guy, he cut all the vices and, you know, the demons out of his life in terms of addiction and alcohol and things of that nature. He improved his diet. He bulked up 30 pounds. He ran 4 to 5 miles every day. He weightlifted. And like, they were like, oh, he's actually serious. So when Lem and Mel took this to their coach, Joe Schmidt, who is a Hall of Famer himself, and Lem Barney is a Hall of Famer as well, Joe Schmidt was like, no, there's absolutely no way that I'm doing this. One, he said, the guy has never played football before, and this just isn't something that you do on a whim. And two, he was like, I'm a fan of Marvin Gaye. There's no way that I would put Marvin Gaye on the football field and have him run across the middle and get, you know, decapitated by Mean Joe Green. He was like, I could never live with myself if I destroyed Marvin Gaye's career because he wanted to scratch a football itch. But after some poking and prodding, Joe Schmidt was like, look, we're having a shirt and shorts tryout at the University of Michigan. And he told Lem and Mel, he was like, tell Marvin to come out. You know, I'll let him run some drills and, you know, that'll be that. But there was no way Marvin was actually going to make the team. But he did get a tryout because there were other people there trying out as well. And Marvin tried out for running back, wide receiver, tight end. And, you know, Joe Schmidt even told me, he was like, he was okay. He was about as good as you could expect a 31-year-old with no football experience to be. He ran routes well. He caught the ball well. He was very coachable. But he told Marvin at the end of the day, like, I can't put you on this team, man. I just can't do it. Like, for your safety and, you know, just for your talent. He was like, your talent is, and your gift to the world is not to play professional football. Your gift to the world is your voice. He said, that's what you need to focus on. And Marvin understood. He was a little bummed out about it that he didn't make the team, because he honestly thought he was going to make the team, but, you know, and but so he appreciated it. He thanked Coach Schmidt, and he was forever indebted to Lem and Mel for doing that for him.
Such a fascinating alternate possible reality. I just love that thought. You know, thinking about the places that Marvin Gaye ended up in his life after this, you know, this sort of golden period when he had the community of his friends and the community that made it possible for him to record What's Going On. I was thinking about that, the difficult times that came later, and I was thinking about something you said on ESPN recently about the daily pain that every black man has to overcome simply by living in the reality of America. Now, for sure, Marvin Gaye had some very specific mental health issues. But in your research for the piece, was it ever impressed upon you that Marvin Gaye was dealing with the exact same outward pressures that every other black person in Detroit and in America was dealing with?
Yeah, Marvin, as you said, Marvin had his own mental health issues that, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, we didn't know this is mental health awareness. We know that now. But, you know, some of that came from the society that he grew up in. You know, what he witnessed, what he watched. He was very distraught by Malcolm X's assassination. He was very distraught by Dr. King's assassination, the Vietnam War. We spoke about that. And he saw the daily micro and macro aggressions about being a black man and a black woman in this country. So, and he took all of these issues personally, like he put them on his shoulders, and it reflected in his music, and it made for timeless music. It made for great music, but we don't always understand what that weight feels like when the song goes off. Once the Marvin Gaye album went off in the house, you didn't really know what Marvin Gaye was doing. You didn't know what he was experiencing, and he dealt with a lot of mental anguish, maybe from stuff that he could control, but the bulk of it, was stuff that he couldn't control.
Justin Tinsley, thank you so much, both for the initial story that you wrote, which was our last moments with Mel Farr publicly before he died suddenly at the age of 70. We thank you for what you shared with them and what you shared with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's always a joy and pleasure to be here with you.
You can read Justin Tinsley's writing on culture and sports at The Undefeated. Coming up, from the Vietnam War to social and political unrest at home, a personal story of why what's going on hits so hard in Detroit.
The typical attitude was, why are we fighting in Vietnam instead of defending our communities right here in the United States?
That's after the break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the release of Marvin Gaye's album, What's Going On, by looking back at what was going on with Marvin in his home of Detroit.
Detroit in 1971, at that point, the city was definitely a majority black city. It had turned that corner. It was the hub of the automobile industry. It was critical in terms of the labor movement, and also a burgeoning black middle class as well.
Melba Boyd, poet, editor, and distinguished professor in African American studies at Wayne State University, was 21 years old the year that What's Going On was released. At that time, she was in school, taking part in protests at Western Michigan University. But Boyd was born and raised in Detroit, and her family was living at the heart of experiences that informed Marvin Gaye's writing. She watched men in her family traumatized by police violence. Her brother and cousin did community-based anti-drug work and took part in storied gunfights with the police. Several of her family members served in Vietnam. Melba Boyd described for us what Detroit was like in 1971 that was maybe different than what people see today.
1971, of course, is the beginning of the next decade, but also it's a continuation of a lot of the social issues that were raised during the 1950s and 60s. And also, we're in the thick of the Vietnam War. And so a lot of young men, you know, were being drafted. I had two brothers who actually served in Vietnam. And there was also just a lot of protests and concern and issues. For example, this is also the point at which black students are demanding that the university provide courses that are more relevant to the broader student population. And so they're having to deal with these kinds of demands coming from the students with regards to, you know, black studies and Latino studies, opening up ethnic studies to address a history and cultures that have been either ignored and or misrepresented. And so a lot of things were happening in Detroit, both politically, culturally, socially. There was big changes occurring, and not just in terms of the black student movement or the black people in the city of Detroit addressing certain issues. Police brutality was a big problem. So these kinds of issues were really in the forefront. And by Detroit being a majority black city, and of course the largest city in the state of Michigan, it was pretty much the focal point. Because even though many of us went to university elsewhere, we did, our homes were in Detroit. And this is where we returned. This is where pretty much made our careers and where we were, you know, grounded. Again, this is also, obviously, the home of Motown. And our movement was, and I'd say our population was very much influenced, culture was influenced by Motown music. That's the music that I grew up on when high school during the 1960s. It's also the music, I think, the soundtrack of a lot of what was happening. Although most of the Motown music during the 1960s did not have a political bent, but it had a presence in our, shall we say, the atmosphere. And of course, as time goes on and history begins to require other kinds of creative expressions, I think at that point it became necessary for Motown Records to shift its focus away from trying to become mainstream per se by not having anything that would necessarily alienate a broader audience, because music itself, not just in Detroit but elsewhere, was becoming, you know, more political. And so the whole sort of sense of American musical expression was changing in the 1970s. Certainly in 1971, we began to see things really take off.
Marvin Gaye spends a good portion of What's Going On talking about the war in Vietnam, or the desire to end the war and bring people home. What was the impact of that the war was having, and the impact of veterans returning home from the war to Detroit?
Well, the main issue was that there was also a peace movement that's going on at the same time that we're having these social protests. Mind you, the civil rights movement was nonviolent resistance, and that theme carried over into also protests against the Vietnam War.
1971 was also the year that the Stress Unit was created in Detroit's police department, and Stress stood for Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets. This was a unit that became notorious for brutality against black Detroiters and is still discussed today. How quickly did the impact of the unit's work become known in the city?
Since the city was, you know, we were pretty politicized at the time, and again, Stress was created in response to the 67 rebellion. And it's very ironic because the fact of the matter was that what caused the rebellion was police brutality and repression. And the response of the police department and the city was to set up a unit, a decoy unit, that went into the community and allegedly were supposed to be about the business of discouraging, you know, robberies and attacks on people, when actually it was essentially a decoy unit which actually engaged in entrapment. They were inducing persons who might otherwise have not even committed a crime to do that. But it also, there was just all kinds of questionable acts of brutality. You know, there were bodies that could be found, and they would say it was dope-related, and we used to say it was probably cop-related. The police force was very corrupt during this time, and of course, there's a whole Black Power movement that is occurring in the late 60s, early 70s, and they're responding to this in kind. So you have a number of encounters in political situations and circumstances with the police. And so you've got repression of the black community in the city, and at the same time, they're stepping up the drafting of young men to fight in Vietnam. And so the typical sort of attitude was, why are we fighting in Vietnam and instead of defending our communities right here in the United States? So it was a dichotomy that, you know, really haunted us during those years. And obviously the stress controversy, the shootouts with the police, it really led to ultimately the election of Coleman Alexander Young as mayor of the city, who was running against the police chief. And so, as one poet friend of mine, Glenn Maniscalco, said during this time, it's not a question of black and white, it's a question of life and death. It was a very, very intense period in 1971.
Melba, do you think that what's going on read that year to people you know as an appeal directly on the plight of police brutality, or as a broader statement on this this dichotomy that you mentioned of fighting the war, sending young men to fight this war in Vietnam when they weren't even safe at home?
Well, actually, when you listen to the lyrics, you know, they really address the whole mood. I mean, it's the war. It's the protests against beating people who are protesting, whether it be against the police, it's protests against the war. It's basically, we're at a point where the violence is not benefiting anything on a rational level. What is this? Why are we engaged in a war that really we felt was none of our business? And yet at home they were saying they were fighting, you know, communism and the threat of democracy. And we're saying, well, we don't have those here. So how do you go and police a foreign nation when you can't even get your own police under control? So they're definitely interrelated, because people were going, many of the same people were going to the different protests.
Yeah. Melba, how does that song sound to you today?
Well, it's appropriate. I mean, I listen to it often. Some of the issues, the planet is still plagued by wars rather than trying to, as he says, you know, only love can conquer hate. You've got this ongoing conflict in the Middle East. You know, we still got, you know, issues with repressive police tactics and aggression. We still got issues of poverty right here in the city of Detroit. There are high levels of unemployment and poverty, and these are issues that are not adequately being, you know, addressed, you know, in a society or a culture and a government that has the resources, if indeed they want to resolve human suffering. So the song is still relevant, because in many ways those circumstances, they've evolved and they've changed, but essentially we're still faced with the same problems. We're still dealing with people protesting about these issues. We're looking again at Israel and Palestine. I mean, all this is It's going on. It was going on then. It's going on now.
Melba Boyd is a distinguished professor in African American Studies at Wayne State University. Melba, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for talking to us about this.
Okay, thank you.
It's quite possible that the title track of What's Going On endures in popularity because of its ultimately hopeful message of peace. But it's notable that though this is how Marvin Gaye's groundbreaking album begins, it ends on a more industrial note that conveys the harsh edges and realities of black life in the city. If What's Going On is the Martin Luther King message of the record, consider that you might find Malcolm X at the end in Inner City Blues, two aligning messages delivered in much different packages. Stephen Henderson, host of Detroit Today on WDET, has spent a lot of time thinking about the poetry of this album. We're going to start with his favorite track, What's Happening, Brother, the one that has a tough job of following the title track.
So the second song really has a huge job in maintaining that momentum, but then also kind of trying to redefine it so that you can get to the later parts of the album. And I have always loved the way What's Happening, Brother does that, both musically and lyrically. You know, musically, it picks up right where What's Going On leaves off. Again, those strains of What's Going On that appear over and over again throughout the album are right there at the beginning. But then it is this almost celebratory set of lyrics. You know, first line, hey baby, what you know good.
I'm just getting back, but you knew I would. War is hell, when will it end?
This idea of somebody coming back from, in this case, Vietnam, coming back to the world and announcing that he wants to know what's happening that's good in the community that he left behind. You know, he talks about the things that aren't working.
Can't find no work, can't find no job, my friend. Money is tighter than it's ever been. Say, man, I just don't understand what's going on across this land.
The experience that he had in war, and the idea that you come home to community that's torn apart and there's not work, there's not money. But then he goes on to just ask, what's happening? What's happening in our neighborhood? Is our baseball team still good? Are people still dancing where we used to dance? What are the things that I missed while I was gone? And it's hopeful in the sense that it suggests the resilience, I think, that is so intrinsic to the African-American community. What I miss while I was gone? And can we pick back up where we left off with that relationship, with the idea that even though things aren't great across the board for us, that we have joy and we have interest and we have connection with one another.
We talk a lot about the title track. It's probably the tune that most Americans recognize, but maybe not as often about Inner City Blues. What resonates for you about that one?
It is the counterpose, I guess, to the title track. It is a much more pointed indictment of what life in America was like for people who live in the inner city, African Americans, and how dismissed, I guess, they feel by the priorities of white America and the government. The contrasts that the lyrics draw between the things that the government is doing and the lives that black people are living is just much starker than it is in What's Going On. And if you think about just the titles of the two tracks, What's Going On is a question. It's a real sort of provocative interrogatory about why are these things happening and they don't make sense to me. Inner City Blues, which is also kind of subtitled Make Me Wanna Holler, is saying this is what's happening and it's wrong and we need to do better.
There's a poetic turn with Inner City Blues conveyed in the instrumentation as well, as we hear reflections and sort of callbacks from What's Going On from the beginning of the album. What do you think is the message there?
Well, I mean, you find that in many places throughout this album, right? That the strains, the musical strains of What's Going On pop up over and over and over again. And in this particular song, they come in at the end. And there's an explicit callback to some of the lyrics from What's Going On. And then the rhythm that starts the album off reappears in a very spare version at the very end of Inner City Blues. It is the moment for me when I listen to the album that the hair always just stands up on the back of my neck when you hear him go back to those first lines of what's going on at the very end of Inner City Blues. It is a perfect wrap on the album as a piece of journalism, even the idea of the story ending where it began is genius.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you so much for being with us. Have a good weekend. Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.